Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode of This Is What Democracy Looks Like, a podcast about deepening democracy. Each week, we welcome a guest on to teach us about an idea that could help extend more power to more people in more ways, that could increase our voices in the forces that govern our lives, that could help us co-create our shared world. I'm your host, Pete Davis, director of the Democracy Policy Network. This week, we're talking community wealth building with Stephanie Geller. Let's go.
Sing me a song.
Stephanie Geller is the founder and director of Community Wealth Builders, a nonprofit initiative focused on promoting and catalyzing community wealth building models and strategies across Baltimore. She also is the co-founder and co-director of the nation's first locally focused grassroots crowdfunding platform, the Maryland Neighborhood Exchange, which aims to foster a more sustainable, robust, and resilient local economy by expanding investment crowdfunding across the state. Stephanie, thank you so much for coming on. This Is What Democracy Looks Like.
Thanks for having me.
I would like to get into the weeds eventually about what community wealth building is, but first I'd love to start with how, Stephanie, did you get started in this line of work? Could you tell us about the journey to community wealth building for you?
So this actually goes back to my childhood, and I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, and I was the kid that was perpetually frustrated with homelessness and poverty and really the vast inequities I saw firsthand in my home city. As a kid, I was the one who organized food drives and volunteered at soup kitchens, and I had the very naive thought that I would go to college, study city planning, maybe a little urban policy, and be able to come back to Baltimore to help address these complex socioeconomic challenges. And I think college did a good job of introducing me to the complexities of systems and the interconnectedness of urban challenges, but I was no better equipped to really do anything. And I actually got really lucky. My first internship out of college, or my first job actually, was with Gar Alperovitz, who was one of the founders many years after this of the Democracy Collaborative, which has really become one of the, I think, the best think tank in the country right now on community wealth building strategies. But back then, we didn't even know that term, and I was a researcher for him, and I was charged to really look at models around the world that were fostering more sustainable, equitable communities, and that research opened my eyes for the first time about cooperatives and community land trusts and worker ownership. And the more I learned about these inclusive models that were really bringing power and resources back to communities, disinvested communities like my own Baltimore, the more hooked I became. And one reason I'm glad you started this way, because I like to mention this journey because I think it really helps underscore a big gap in education. It took a luck experience for me to stumble upon these models and learn about them. And that is a frustration that still really troubles me, that for people that go through mainstream education, you're not going to be exposed to these types of models. If you're interested in business, you learn how to create a company. If you're interested in community, you might be steered to a nonprofit world. But the whole notion of community wealth building, which are really models that aim to bring power back and resources back to disinvested areas and that create more equitable, inclusive ownership structures, are still not conventional knowledge and conventional practices that students are coming out of our educational institutions ready to jump in.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like you started your interest in this by seeing all these symptoms of inequality of power, inequality of economic power, and you were trying to fight those, but then you were able to discover upstream that there was a lot we could do upstream that could solve for these problems. Would that be a fair assessment?
Exactly. I was stuck in the Band-Aid solutions and frustrated with those Band-Aid solutions and really looking for what can we do at the systems level, at the macro level, to just, in essence, change the system and change traditional structure so we're not generating the same outcomes?
So when we talk about, I want to get into the weeds now, what is community wealth building? So when we hear about that in this kind of status quo world, you often just hear about, oh, wealth building is just the standard model of try to create jobs in cities and try to help people get those jobs and save money. But what I think you're talking about with community wealth building is not that. It's a different model than the standard way that this happens. So tell us about that. What is community wealth building?
And in many ways, it's the opposite of the standard model. So my city, Baltimore, really relies on a lot of traditional economic development, you know, trying to attract big corporations like Amazon to come here, which create jobs, quantity of jobs, but not quality. And community wealth building, to me, are really any strategy, any model that brings power and resources back to community. And both of those pieces are important because it gives community ownership. It gives community a stake. It really empowers people so that decisions are made with a focus on people, the world. When I think of community wealth building, I think of a broad range of strategies, but they're really tied by bringing resources and power back to community. So community and people are prioritized. Models that really are more inclusive and models that are more equitable. Worker ownership is a model that I think has achieved more prominence over the past few years because there's just so much data about how empowering it is for workers and how the businesses do well and thus create community wealth. Really different types of economic models that in some ways flip traditional capitalism on its head rather than having that triangle with one person at the top, figuring out ways for all community members to build assets and for all community members to be involved in some type of decision making.
One interesting thing about how you talk about community wealth building is we know about the cooperative world, the world of worker ownership, but you see this as an umbrella term, I'm sensing, beyond just co-ops. Like there's also local crowdfunding and ways of neighborhoods helping other people. You include even small businesses that don't necessarily have worker ownership, but are rooted in the neighborhood and not coming from the outside. Could you talk a little bit about how it's an umbrella term?
So for us, it is an umbrella term to really include all different types of strategies. I feel like in many ways, my work is on the line. So there's some things we do at Community Wealth Builders that are a little bit more mainstream, just promoting locally owned businesses. But to me, as you move down the line, the more inclusive the structure is, the more capitalism is truly flipped on its head, the better chance you do have to really address generational poverty and really the long-term socioeconomic challenges that a city like Baltimore has faced for decades. One reason we are a little more inclusive is that there's a big learning curve. People need to first understand the importance of local, the importance of place. And as people move along the spectrum, it's almost like you ask a little kid, what do you want to be when you grow up? No one's going to say, I want to be a member of, or I want to be a worker owner. But this is still so new to people. So oftentimes our work that focuses on local business is really a first good step for community residents to embrace.
Wonderful. And so we've been talking abstractly and globally about community wealth building. Now our listeners probably are like, okay, give me some concrete examples. So I'd love a little bit of a tour of some of your favorite examples of community wealth building in action.
So one of my favorite models is Cleveland's Evergreen Cooperatives. And to me, the logic model of that is just in some ways, in essence, what community wealth building is. So in Cleveland, over a decade ago now, I think, the anchor institutions, and when I say anchor, places that aren't going to leave Cleveland, so hospitals, universities, they came together frustrated with sort of the long-term challenges facing Cleveland. And traditionally, institutions like that have tried to help community through the Band-Aids, you know, approach. So a hospital could provide free medical care to low-income populations. A university might connect some of its students to help in low-income schools. And they decided to take a different approach and look at themselves as an economic muscle and look at what they were buying. And they began this project actually by recognizing and through research that they were spending collectively through $3 billion a year on goods and services. And almost all of that was leaving Cleveland. So their community wealth building strategy really began with trying to create businesses, local businesses that would enable them to buy locally rather than having their dollars leak out. And what was especially interesting to me, rather than just create these as traditional businesses, they were created as worker-owned businesses. So everyone that works there actually not only is getting a livable wage, but has the ability to build assets. And pushing the model even, or make it even more interesting, they have targeted returning citizens for these jobs, not only to create jobs, not only to create community-focused businesses that are circulating dollars, but creating jobs for people that traditionally have had a hard time getting viable employment. So there are now three businesses that are part of this network. And that logic model to me is one that really every locality across this country should be using. If you have these institutions that are never leaving, that are always going to buy some goods and services. So for example, in Cleveland, one of the first businesses they started is a laundry. Their hospital's always going to have sheets and uniforms to wash. So if you can figure out what are the items or services that your anchors are consistently buying and currently buying from places not locally, that's to me just in some ways brilliant.
I love that. So you have these institutions that kind of have a connection to the public interest, hospitals, universities, the government itself, right? Through procurement, mm-hmm. schools. The first thing that's really hard of getting any business off the ground is getting money coming in the door as income by having a big customer. So they can start with a big customer, build up, use that to build up the skills and operations, and then eventually get other customers. What an amazing thing. Any other models you'd love to share with us?
So I'm going to talk about another model that's just different to give a flavor of the vast array of models and strategies within community wealth building. So another initiative I love and that has really inspired me is in East Portland, and it's their Community Investment Trust. And their community was facing vacancy and commercial blight. It's a low income population. And, you know, one individual community member could never do anything on their own to affect change. But what happens if a low-income community comes together and starts pooling funds? And that was really the logic model for what they did. They enabled all community members. And when I say they, this was really pioneered by Mercy Corps, which is a large nonprofit out there. But they created a model that enabled low-income community members to invest in a capital pool for as little as $10. And they, over time, amass capital, and that was used to really for the community itself to buy a vacant shopping plaza. And what I love about that project is that it has so many multiple effects. So most of the participants in this, the low-income community members, had never invested before. And this created an opportunity to learn about investment and savings, and an opportunity to build wealth for the first time, to build assets, which we all know is critical to get out of generational poverty. And actually, they've been doing a great job out there just tracking data. And some of the metrics that are so inspirational are how many people after this began saving more and opened their first bank account. So it's a great project from the individual wealth building perspective. From the community wealth building perspective, they were able to revitalize a large shopping plaza. And now there's space for 25 plus locally owned businesses or small nonprofits. So just adding such vibrancy to the community from a commercial side. And then, of course, the business side, creating opportunity for more local businesses to actually have a place in the neighborhood. And what has been especially interesting to me during COVID, these businesses haven't faced some of the severe economic challenges that other businesses across the country are facing because they're really supported now by the community. The community has a financial stake to ensure that this financial or this shopping closet as well.
Yeah, I love that everything about community wealth building seems to be turning all the problems on their heads. So usually when there's development in a place, we have all the classic development problems where it either is not successful or it's successful, drives up housing prices. None of the money flows money out of the community and drives whoever lived there out. And what this does is it flows money back into the community, gives people a stake in the development, and then totally inverts everything on its head. And I love the phrase of the East Portland CIT, which is moving from owing to owning, which is, it's not just this, usually what you with this kind of financial literacy and financial responsibility rhetoric out there, it's all you're bad for being in debt and you must be a more responsible player in the capitalist system. But what this is saying is let's come up with models bigger than you that actually help you when you participate in the system.
And I think most people have this conventional framing. Property development, real estate projects are done by traditional developers and they enable a few people to get wealthy. And, you know, these types of models really aim to flip people's basic understanding on its head. Why can't a community own its commercial property? Shouldn't the community actually benefit from business growth and enable businesses that it wants, that meet community interests, to be part of its commercial area? So it's really models that aim to bring community power and aim to root real assets in communities so all communities ideally can thrive.
Wonderful. And now there's one thing to talk about this work nationally and promote it, which the Democracy Collaborative does. You have taken this spirit and focused in on your home city of Baltimore. And you're starting to see, can I support and help start a bunch of community wealth building projects in my city? And so I'd love to hear, how has the work of community wealth builders in Baltimore gone for you?
Like I shared before, we work on this line of progressiveness because this is still new to Baltimore. And our work, I always describe, it's in three buckets. So one, we do a lot of education. This is still new to so many people. So just getting out there, doing workshops on community wealth building 101. We do advocacy work because policymakers still don't know really about these types of models. So pushing, educating from the policy side. And while we're doing this, we're attempting to also do real projects on the ground so people can understand and get a flavor of what we're doing. One of our newest projects, I can just share with your listeners so you can get a sense of our work. It's called the Maryland Neighborhood Exchange. And when you made the introduction, sort of a mouthful, but we are the first and remain the only locally focused grassroots investment crowdfunding platform in the nation. And what does that mean? So we've been working on the ground with local business for 4 years. And one thing we've heard over and over again from businesses, locally owned businesses in Baltimore, especially Black owned businesses in Baltimore, has been how challenging it is to get affordable capital from traditional institutions, from banks. So through the community wealth building lens, you know, it's sort of like, all right, what are other strategies? Banks clearly are making this frustrating. How can we engage community in some way that's a win-win from the community side and the business side? And law has changed around grassroots investment crowdfunding, which basically means since 2016, it now is legal and easy for any person resident in any community to invest in a local business. Why isn't this happening?
And this is the Jobs Act for our listeners, correct?
The Jobs Act passed in 2012, and it took till 2016 for the SEC to issue regulations. And actually, March 15th, so just a few days ago, the SEC actually relaxed a lot of regulation, recognizing the positive impact of this and winning grassroots investment crowdfunding to be even more impactful in COVID recovery?
We have a pretty wonky listenership, so we go into the weeds a bit. Just one more thing on that. So it used to be that you had to be an accredited investor to invest in small businesses, but that means you have to put $10,000 down or something like this.
And to do it easily, to do it without any expense. So before, perhaps if you were unaccredited, you could hire an attorney and figure out how to do this. But typically, unaccredited investors want to invest like $100 in a local business. Nothing so grand. So the amount of effort and the amount of legal help you'd need would probably be more expensive than your actual investment in a local business.
And so you could do these kind of crowdfunding out of the good of your heart, like giving money to a local business or something, or you could be part of a purchasing plan. But now you can actually get a percentage in the equity in the local business. Am I right to say?
Yeah. So when I use the term grassroots investment crowdfunding, I am not referring to GoFundMe, Kickstarter. I am referring to people now being able to take their money, invest in a business, and get some type of financial return. And it can be equity. I work with businesses that are interested in structuring debt products where they promise investors a certain interest paid quarterly. There are also shared revenue notes, which are extremely popular now in COVID. So businesses offering investors a small percentage of revenue. But just to backtrack to give a little more context for this project. So businesses having a hard time accessing capital. So recognizing, wow, can we use this new piece of the new SEC regulations to figure out how to really drive investment crowdfunding at the local level? And while investment crowdfunding has been legal since 2016, it really hasn't multiplied locally the way it was actually expected to. And our hypothesis with the Maryland Neighborhood Exchange was one reason investment crowdfunding didn't have as much impact as its sort of initial supporters were expecting was because this was never really thought about locally. And what I mean by that is to do investment crowdfunding, you have to have your campaign on a federally licensed portal. And the portals that existed all had different flavors, but they were all nationally focused. Some focused on ag businesses, some focused on biotech. There was none that was really trying to promote all businesses within a small geography. And that's really what led us to create the Maryland Neighborhood Exchange, thinking, could we have some type of local initiative that educated businesses that you can now raise money from your customers and community, that educated Baltimore residents, you love Baltimore, you shop locally, you go to farmers market, you wear your purple on Friday, which is a very important Baltimore thing. People don't know that you can also have impact on the local economy by investing locally. So you educate your businesses, you educate your residents, and then you have a platform. So it's really easy for the businesses that are seeking local investment to find local people that are excited to invest. And that was really the logic behind the Maryland Neighborhood Exchange. We launched it in December 2019, really with the initial goal to help Baltimore's local and Black-owned businesses get growth capital. And COVID really took a project that we thought would be a smaller piece of Community Wealth Builder's overall programmatic offerings and made this one of our largest programs, because now the universe of locally owned businesses in Baltimore needs capital for a whole range of reasons. What we love about this and why this fits so well within community wealth building is that it, again, hits those tiers, individual level. Community members they have real, easy, tangible, new investment opportunities. You can invest oftentimes in a local business for as little as $25. And you're typically knowing the business that's seeking investment. But for people that have never invested before, it's a great way to jump in the game and have a way to start building assets. On the business side, the businesses that we work with them to set their own terms. So does equity make sense? Does debt make sense? Does shared revenue make sense? The goal is to create a win for businesses so they can get the capital that they need without crippling them. So it's truly affordable capital. And then from the community wealth building side, if you can give your customers, your community, a small financial stake in your business, they're going to be customers for life. They're going to be championing your business. It really creates and cements that bond. So if you talk about how do you create a more sustainable, resilient economy, to me, this is the model. Your customers and community also become your investors.
So walk us through like a business that's using this crowdfunding platform.
So I do want to point out that SEC has heavy regulations around what you're really allowed to say about this. So I can give you sort of the overall picture, but not the intimate things about this opportunity. But everyone can actually visit our website, the Maryland Neighborhood Exchange, and see the list of all the businesses we're currently working with and click on the link and see exactly what they're offering. But for example, so we work with businesses that really have had a hard time getting traditional capital, but that are loved by community and have a huge base. And one example, it's one of the latest businesses we're working with. It is called Sporty Dog Creations. It's Black woman owned. It's actually a mother-daughter team, and they make hot dogs from scratch and toppings from scratch. And before COVID, they were one of the most popular businesses that actually went to sporting events, local football games and soccer games. And they sold to people that were actually out near other people enjoying something. And COVID, of course, crushed their business model. They never had a physical location. So with COVID, they've decided, all right, we want to open physical shops. So they are now seeking capital. We're supporting them, and they are offering investors a small percent of their revenue over time. And the reason they opted for that is because of COVID. They're not sure. Baltimore City still has very strict regulations on businesses and still really unsure when businesses will be able to open and operate at a full capacity. So this is enabling them to get the capital they need to set up their physical location. And they're actually located there now doing carryout, but they're working to set up an actual sit-down restaurant, and they'll be able to pay back really based on the environment. And what's especially neat in Baltimore, so they are moving into a historic building called the Women's Industrial Exchange, and it traditionally housed women-owned craft businesses and was attached to the restaurant. So for me, the fact that this is not only enabling this awesome mother-daughter Black-owned business team get off the ground, but get them off the ground in this historic Baltimore building that has been vacant for many years. And it's really in the heart of our downtown area.
Oh, wonderful. So a revenue share, so like equity loan versus revenue share. Equity is like you own a percentage of the business. So if the business was ever sold or if the business wanted to pay dividends, you would get money based on that. Loan is they just have to pay you back no matter what at a certain rate. And then I'm guessing revenue share is we bring in revenue over a certain amount of years and I'm going to give you a certain percentage of that revenue based on this. So if I put in $25, I might get, I don't know, 0.001% of some revenue. Is that how it works?
Is a debt instrument. And basically, you are offering a small percent of your revenue until a certain multiple is reached. So for example, if you decide your multiple is going to be 1.2, if someone invests $100, the most they will get is 120. And when they finally get 120 back from you, then their relationship with you ends. So they could get to their 120 after 1 year. They could get there after 3 years. They could get there after 5 years. It really depends on a business's revenue and their revenue model. So it's promising people, everyone will know this is the end goal, but when I get there is indeterminate.
This is just so great to hear. I love the fact that this kind of gives you a stake in something. it gives you actual money. You know, if everything works out, it's you did a good thing, but you get your money back and maybe some more, and you build a relationship with something in your community. It's tying people together. What a beautiful thing. Final question is, a lot of our listeners are state policy leaders. And what do you think state leaders can do to support community wealth building and organizations like yours?
So at the most basic, I think easiest level, because it doesn't really involve money, is talking about it. Visibility, right? When you have your platform, when you talk about what you care about, mention community wealth building models, mention worker ownership. I think, again, it goes back to one big frustration I have had perpetually, that these models are not in people's heads. They're not in people's toolboxes. So when a community is facing a challenge, Baltimore's typical approach is just trying to attract these national corporations that may create large quantities of jobs, but not the quality jobs, not the asset building opportunities that are going to be truly empowering for everyone. So truly just at the basic level, policymakers can talk about it, give it visibility, talk about the benefits. There's also procurement. Procurement is a big muscle of government, and governments buy goods and services typically a lot. And right now, of course, there are typical procurement preferences that might go to minority-owned businesses and certain types of owners, but why not consider procurement to businesses that are worker-owned, that are cooperative, that have more inclusive ownership structure? So to me, those are the easiest ways, because they don't necessarily require government to allocate scarce resources. But of course, resources are also important to build these types of models. And core challenge is that most traditional lending institutions don't necessarily understand these models, and they're complicated. So their tools, banks, the way they typically operate to give money, don't really fit in with what these models is like, trying to fit a circle and a triangle together. So access to capital, and access to capital, I think, needs to happen at the ecosystem level. So really helping entities that are thought partners in this, that are providing support to actually the on-the-ground models, businesses that are structured in a more equitable, inclusive way.
That's wonderful. Stephanie Geller, thank you so much for coming on. This is What Democracy Looks Like. Anything you want to plug that listeners should be paying attention to?
So if people want to learn more, certainly check out our website, communitywealthbuilders.org, and the Maryland Neighborhood Exchange, the project I mentioned, has its own tab, and you can go check out the local businesses seeking capital, click on them. And if you want to have a impact, typically you can invest for as little as $25 in a locally owned business. And if your community is interested in this at all, this is my passion. This is community wealth building is really in my heart. I welcome the opportunity to share more about our other programs, about some of the programs I've talked about, and help to spark conversations and projects in other localities as well.
We say at the intro of our episodes that when we say deepening democracy, we mean more power to more people in more ways. And you, Stephanie, and your work is such a great example of more power to more people in a dynamic flourishing of more ways. So thank you so much for your work, and thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much.